Hello, and welcome to episode 50 of the Story Hack Podcast. The Story Hack Podcast features action, adventure, and mystery stories, mostly from the public domain. Story Hack is also a print magazine, which publishes new action and adventure stories in a wide variety of genres. Visit storyhack.com today for more information. Today will be part one in a series, Reading the Prince of Mars Returns by Philip Francis Nolan.
The Prince of Mars Returns by Philip Francis Nolan. Chapter 1. To Mars. I, Captain Daniel J. Hanley, Chief Meteorologist of the General Rocket Corporation, had no intention of going to Mars when I stepped into the new space car and pressed gently but with finality on the gravity screen lever. I was conscious only of a great urge to get as far away as possible from a certain young woman who had, but why go into details about that? It is enough that I didn't fully realize what I was doing. And as a result, here I was, the first man ever to pass beyond the stratosphere of Earth, actually hovering a scant mile above a Martian landscape, trembling with suppressed excitement and giving not a thought to the girl who had driven me to my mad, premature plunge into space. I faced infinity with reckless abandon, and found that I liked it. What did it matter if the end came in a day, week, or month? Why, there were no days, weeks, or months in interplanetary space. Only eternal, blazing noon on one side of my tiny craft, and everlasting midnight on the other, while countless galaxies gleamed upon me in new glory from all sides. But I landed on Mars instead of some other planet, was due solely to chance. In hurling my tiny craft madly, blindly away from Earth, I happened to set it on an orbit that brought it closer to Mars than to any other heavenly body. As I drew nearer, the planet grew in size and in interest, until it entirely filled the great lens of my wide-angle scope. Its mountain ranges and peculiar canals became plainly visible. I manipulated my rocket blasts a bit and swung closer. There was no indication that the canals were man-made. Rather, they seemed furrows caused by glancing blows of meteors, and there were many craters which, though small like those of the moon, appeared to be the result of head-on meteoric impact. As the planet grew still larger, I could see that there were no oceans and continents in the sense that we know them on Earth. Nevertheless, the divisions between the ice caps, polar seas, solid vegetation belts, canal-irrigated sections, and finally the vast and eternally dry red equatorial belt were clear and sharp. The northern and southern hemispheres, widely divided by this belt, seemed duplicates. Why not inspect the planet at close range? I asked myself. So here I was, easing down over a countryside such as no man of Earth had ever seen. Through the forward port I gazed upon a country of scrubby, dwarfed, cactus-like trees and shrubs, stretching away drably to where a ribbon of water one of these much-discussed canals sparkled. To my left, toward the equatorial belt, the vegetation became more dwarfed and sparse, until its pale, yellow-green blended into the deeper, reddish tint of the arid desert. To my right, a rolling plain swelled into distant hills heavily covered with a yellow-green foliage. On the horizon, a range of gaunt, jagged mountains flashed and shimmered like crystal in the pale, cool sunlight. Quartz, I muttered. They must be pure quartz. I brought my craft gently down on the bank of a little river that meandered along the canal or valley. With trembling fingers, I opened the valve of one of the test chambers and watched the pressure gauge. I had feared an uncomfortably rare air, but the gauge registered a pressure no less than that of mountainous regions at home. There was more carbon dioxide and more hydrogen, but the oxygen content was about the same as on Earth. I could leave my little metal shell and walk around on a new planet. Excited, I threw back the hatch at the top of my little hemispherical craft and leaped out joyously. I landed, not where I expected, but 15 or 20 feet beyond. I had forgotten that I would weigh only about a third as much as on Earth. But with a little practice, I found I could gauge my muscular effort instinctively to the desired distance. It was a delightful amusement, leaping 25 or 30 feet with the effort of an 8 or 10 foot jump. But finally I gave some consideration to my position. And now, I told myself, here I am on an utterly strange planet. I have no idea what dangers I may have to face. I don't know whether intelligent beings live here or, if they do, what their attitude toward me might be. It might be just as well to have an ace in the hole. I'll hide my ship, mark the spot well, and then if by any chance things should get too hot for me, I'll have the means in reserve to do a fade-out. I studied the banks of the stream. Obviously the little river was at high-water mark. That was good. There would be no more powerful current than this to wash my ship away then, for it was my intention to sink her in the middle of the stream. Again I climbed aboard, closed the hatch. Letting my space car drift a few feet above the water, I maneuvered over the center of the stream and then submerged. The ship went about 10 feet below the surface. I had previously unloaded the equipment I meant to use, so nothing remained but to put everything in order, enter the airlock, adjust the pressure, and dive down and out through the port. I realized, as I donned my woolen shirt, leather breeches and puttees, that the sun did not shed as much warmth on Mars as on Earth. It seemed scarcely more than half the size to which I was accustomed. As I rolled up my blankets, I had little doubt I would need them after nightfall. As yet, I had seen no sign of animal life, but there were many spots on Earth where a visitor would find none for miles. So that proved nothing. I strapped a heavy automatic to my thigh, clasped on a cartridge belt. As an extra precaution, I slipped a smaller automatic in a shoulder holster, which I put on under my shirt. For the rest, I thought my hunting knife and short-handled axe might prove serviceable. Marking the position of my submerged spacecraft by carefully sighting the distant mountain peaks on crossed lines, I shouldered my light pack and hiked toward the gleaming, flashing mountain range. It was glorious to weigh no more than about 60 pounds, and yet have muscles that had been accustomed to carrying 170. Walking did not give them the exercise they demanded after the long period cooped up in the little space ship, so I ran with exhilarating lightness, practicing long and high leaps as I went, and shouting, at times, from sheer, unrestrained joy. I had gone about 5 miles when I first saw her. The scrubby undergrowth had given way to another cactus-like type of vegetation, the trees of Mars, slim and tall with stubby, blunt branches. They bore no leaves. Rather, both trunks and branches seemed to be leaves in themselves, pale yellow-green and semi-transparent. A thin syrupy sap ran freely from one, which I scored with my axe. The sudden flash of a movement somewhere ahead of me arrested my eye. Abruptly I halted, standing motionless, alert. I saw nothing but the yellow-green trees. I shifted my axe to my left hand. Quietly, my right fist rested on the butt of my automatic. I advanced, poised for instant action. From somewhere ahead came a metallic twang. I ducked. A heavy missile thudded into the trunk of a tree directly behind me. Then a girl stepped confidently forth, about 20 feet away. Evidently, she thought she had hit me, for her first reaction was to start back at the sight of me standing there. Hastily, she dropped the 4-foot tube she held in her hand, and in something like a panic, tugged at a kind of quiver, or a sheath, slung across her shoulder, until she held another tube pointed straight at me. For some moments we stood motionless, gazing at each other in amazement. I had rather expected to find life of some sort on Mars, and was even hoping to find intelligent creatures of some sort. But to find a pretty, golden-haired Amazon in green kilts, soft leather leggings and loose, sleeveless blouse that did not by any means conceal her slender form, well, that took my breath away. Chapter 2. Lil Rin of the Tar, Enner. At last the significance of that tube, pointed at my chest unhesitatingly, broke through my stunned thoughts. I dropped my axe, held out my empty hands in a gesture of friendliness. "Can't we be friends?" I smiled, knowing full well my language would not be understood, but hoping that my tone might. Her reply, uttered in a soft, euphonious tongue, was obviously a question. And feeling a bit foolish, I tried to indicate by gestures that I could not understand her. For a moment she watched me. A quizzical look crept into her green-blue eyes. Then she laughed and lowered the tube a bit, but quickly covered me again as I stepped forward. She was taking no chances, it seemed, for again her eyes flashed a warning as I sought to recover my axe. She motioned me back. As I complied, she walked over and picked up the axe herself, never taking her eyes off me. Next, she motioned toward my knife. I tossed it at her feet, and she picked this up also. The automatic strap to my leg meant nothing to her, seemingly. She did not demand it. Feeling safer now, she stood back and surveyed me speculatively. At length, she motioned me to precede her in the direction of the distant mountains. This I did willingly enough, for I felt that with my two guns I could always command the situation, even if her people did not prove as friendly in their attitude as I hoped. I had been eyeing those tubes she carried in the quiver, and had come to the conclusion, both from their appearance and their peculiar, twanging, metallic quality, that they hurled their bullets by the force of a coil spring. As I marched on, occasionally turning to look at my fair captor, the vegetation became thicker, and the hills and ravines more pronounced. Coming to the top of one of these ridges, she called out, and by gestures commanded me to turn sharply to the right. A bit later she paused and gave a peculiar whistling signal. This was replied to from some point ahead, and we went on. I hardly know what I expected to see. It certainly was not the type of structure we finally came upon. Sheer walls of a glassy, translucent, solid material rose to a height of 50 feet or more. At least I judged them to be solid. I could see no joints or crevices. There was a triangular opening. Through this peculiarly shaped gateway I strode on a pavement of material similar to the wall, which was worn smoothly and deeply as though by centuries of countless feet. The space inside the wall was diamond-shaped, about 1,000 feet long and probably 3/4 that distance at its greatest width. The entire space was paved with a solid sheet of the glassy material in which smooth troughs or channels had been worn. In contrast with the solid and permanent nature of the wall space, which gave evidence of high engineering skill, there was no shelter in sight except some 2 or 3 dozen tents, not unlike Indian teepees of pale green leather over metal framework. There were 10 of men and women about, all garbed exactly like my captor, golden-haired, blue-eyed people of somewhat slighter build than the average on earth, but otherwise remarkable only for the uniform perfection of their physique. Men and women were of about the same height, none of them coming within several inches of my 6 feet. The men were only slightly sturdier than the women, and all seemed in perfect physical condition, like trained athletes. I did not see a fat nor a flabby individual among them. Our appearance caused no great excitement, though a number gathered around us, and my captor was questioned with mild curiosity. But they made way for us readily enough at her explanation. Quite at ease now, she walked beside me, having sheathed her gun, touching my arm occasionally to direct me toward a tent in the center, somewhat larger than the others. It was about 30 feet across, of a high, conical shape. A large, translucent disc set in the top of the metal framework, let in a soft light. I don't know what she said to the blond-bearded man who sat at the carved, like metal table, but from her tone and the little gesture with which she called his attention to me, it must have been something like a, "Look what I found in the forest, father." There ensued some rapid conversation in that peculiarly mellow tongue. Then, to my considerable embarrassment, they began to examine my apparel and myself with a critical scrutiny, finally motioning me outside where there was more light. That they were both of them greatly puzzled was quite clear. At length, the man who seemed to be the head of the little community endeavored to talk with me by signs. He placed a finger on my chest and looked questioningly at me. I guess I looked foolish, for I did not get him at first. So he pointed to himself. "Her mourner," he said. Then he pointed at the girl and said, "Her little Rin." "Oh," I nodded.
"You mean those are your names?"
Then I pointed to myself and bowed.
Dan Hanley. Captain Daniel J.
Hanley, U.S. Army Reserve Corps, at your service." Daintily said the girl softly, as though the name was somehow both familiar and amazing. Then Hermonia waved his hand, generally, toward the people scattered about the enclosure. "Tar Enner," he said, from which I surmised that their part of their name was a clan or community designation. I smiled and put my finger on his chest. "Mornia," I said.
Ermornir. He seemed a bit taken aback at the freedom of my gesture, but smiled his assent, if a bit wryly. Then I turned to the girl, and suddenly curious to see what would happen, placed my hand boldly on her shoulder as I spoke her name. For an instant, Mornew was about to lash out at me in fury. Lilrin's eyes blazed in indignant resentment. Then suddenly she blushed and tried to act as though I had done nothing she thought unusual, while with a struggle her father strove to assume the same air. Here was no race of barbarians, nor of slaves, but people of high spirit, independence, culture, and quick intelligence. I sensed that I had committed a grievous offense, which was forgiven me instantly in view of my ignorance. I sensed, too, that they must regard me somewhat in the light of a guest. Some imp of perversity led me to puzzle them still further when, after a bit, they motioned me within the tent again, where a meal was laid out on the table. I looked curiously at the unfamiliar viands of fruits and vegetables, most of which I had never seen. There was meat, and a fowl of peculiar shape. All of the tableware was of metal, pale alloy that looked like gold, but was not. The platters were inlaid with iridescent stones, and there were spoons, but no knives. My hosts used the blades which they took from the sheaths at their belts. I made an apologetic gesture and went to my little pack, which had been laid in a corner. From it I took my silver knife and fork and returned to the table. They strove to conceal their curiosity, but stared frankly. It was on the fork that their interest centered. Not only its shape seemed unfamiliar to them, but the sterling silver itself. The girl watched my use of it with a kind of fascination, then actually blushed and giggled when I handed it to her. Her father frowned and made another serious effort to question me by gestures. At last I gathered his meaning. He wanted to know whence I had come. I pointed upward toward the sky. His frown increased, and he shook his head. My explanation wasn't at all satisfactory, it seemed. Nor did I wonder at this. And the thought came to me then that it would be just as well not to try to explain. I wouldn't be believed. Who on earth, say, would be believed if he claimed to be a Martian? True, I might exhibit my little spacecraft in substantiation of my story. But I did not know that sooner or later my life might depend on keeping its existence and its hiding place a secret. So I shrugged and let it go at that. Chapter 3. The Burok. Night came. A new tent was erected for my use. And when at last I tired of the glory of the two Martian moons which swung low and swiftly across the scintillating heavens, and Lilrin had given me a curiously speculative smile of adieu, I went inside and threw myself on the pile of soft skins and silks that evidently was intended as my couch. Almost at once I slept. The days passed swiftly. Little by little I learned their language. It was hard pulling it off at first, but I had always had a certain facility with strange tongues. I learned something, too, of Martian life and history. Mornia, Lilrin's father, was Mjarlr, supreme chief of the Ur, a clan of a race which, like the Cossacks on Earth, was somewhat nomadic in its inclinations and jealously guarded its tribal traditions. Mornia, with his 7 Mjars, or sub-chiefs, was at present in the service of the northern cities. For 5 successive years the clan had contracted with the northern cities to guard the desert gap in the Quartz Mountains and the approaches to it. The work of the clan had consisted chiefly in keeping the territory south of the gap clear of the Duleels, or yellow apes, beasts of almost human intelligence. These Duleels, I gathered, possessed a higher order of mentality than any of their counterparts on Earth. They were tailless, walked erect, but had prehensile feet. They were covered with a golden brown fur, and though larger and more muscular than Martian men, were more human than ape-like in build. They were omnivorous, hunted in packs, had a rudimentary language, and fashioned crude clubs and spears. Yet they were distinctly not human, Lilrin informed me. After 2 or 3 generations of captivity, she said, they make excellent slaves. Unless they taste blood, they can be trusted invariably to be loyal to their masters. They bring higher prices in the slave markets because they are stronger and more docile than men, that is, the domesticated ones are more docile. About two-thirds of the city populations are dual-use slaves. You know, Lilrin looked up at me slyly, the reason I tried to shoot you that day in the forest was because I thought you were a dual-use. We were sitting on an outcropping of rock, a gray scintillating quartz boulder, gazing down a gentle slope toward the canal. There was speculation, and it seemed to me, a bit of suspicion in Lilrin's steady gaze. "Why do you look at me that way, Lilrin?" I asked. "Because I have dark hair, unlike your people." I thought perhaps she had not heard me, for she did not answer at once. For several moments she mused. "Dainenle, you are like no living man on this world," she finally blurted out. Then just as suddenly, she was all solicitude. "I am sorry, I had no right to say such a thing. The ancient custom forbids anything that would make a guest feel uncomfortable. My offense is unpardonable." That was my cue. "No, it isn't, Lilrin," I protested. "You and your people have been so kind to me that explanation is the least." "No, no," she cried, jumping up and putting her hands over her ears. "I won't listen. You mustn't tell me anything." "It wouldn't." A weird, shrill, wailing cry somewhere down the slope in front of us interrupted her. I'm not easily startled, but for an instant I felt a chill shoot up my spine. Lilrin stood in an instant, rigid, motionless, staring pale and wide-eyed in the direction whence the sound had come. "It's a Burok," she gasped, tugging at the quiver in which she carried her bolt-hurting tubes. "Run, Dainenle, run. You can't fight it without bolts, and even then you have to get it with the first shot, or..." Then I saw the thing. It was a gigantic yellow-green spider. Its legs were fully 12 feet long. Suddenly, it straightened them, and the furry body, which had been resting close to the ground, rose as though on stilts. Clearly, the thing sensed our presence and was looking for us. Instantly, those legs began to move with amazing rapidity. The body seemed to swoop down and glide swiftly toward us with an easy, undulating swing. It would be upon us in a moment. Instinctively, I drew my automatic. "Quick, Dainenle, run," said Lilrin sharply, and stepped between me and the poisonous monster. Her tube leveled. There was a whir and a clang. The bolt shot true toward its mark, but with unbelievable agility, the great spider leaped forward. Lilrin uttered a little cry of despair and threw herself in front of me. I squeezed the trigger of my gun. The shots blended into a roar as a succession of stabbing flashes leaped from the muzzle, or I emptied the whole magazine at the thing. As before, the beast leaped sharply to one side, but not quickly enough. The long legs crumpled up, and after one or two convulsive movements, the thing lay still. At that, I believe it had dodged all but the first bullet.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Story Hack Podcast. Make sure to check out Sidearm and Sorcery Volume 3. So, when average people are swallowed up in supernatural trouble, sometimes they have to stand against the darkness by themselves. These are their stories. Included in this volume are 12 new stories of regular people facing the worst the paranormal world has to offer. These heroes may not have powers, but they refuse to be powerless. You can find more information about Sidearm and Sorcery Volume 3 at storyhack.com.